Good evening. Welcome to this evening's reading in the series by Michigan Poets and Writers. This evening will feature Keith Taylor. Let me mention just one thing before I introduce Keith. There's one more reading in the series. I believe that's on May 26th. Judith Minty. There are flyers around for that, so be aware there's one more reading in the series. Also want to mention the new journal, which is the first issue, which is out from Michigan State University Press, Fourth Genre. Particularly mention this because the sort of cornerstone piece in the issue is by our featured reader this evening, Keith Taylor, called Emerson at Hellgate, which is a wonderful piece. So this is we're very excited about the first issue of the Fourth Genre, which is subtitled Explorations in Creative Nonfiction. So now for the introduction of our featured reader. I was thinking how I was going to introduce Keith, who's a good friend of long standing, and the first sentence that absolutely came to mind right away was that Keith Taylor is an original. Keith's poems and short stories express an intimate understanding of literature, geography, history, natural history, and science, yet he's not an academic. His poetry and prose defy easy classification. Sometimes, as in his chapbook, Dream of the Black Wolf, which he wrote while being a writer in residence at the Isle Royale National Park, poetry and prose share the same space. His book of short stories, Life Science, are not short stories by traditional standards, yet they are not essays, journalism, or reportage. While they are deeply North American, which includes the United States and Canada, since Keith is Canadian, I'll give you that secret, they have echoes of such European writers as Kafka and Walzer. As someone who understands the intersection of the historical, the everyday, and the extraordinary, I would be tempted to call Keith a visionary, but I doubt he would care to be called by such a highfalutin term. As I mentioned, Keith is the author of Life Science and Other Stories in the chapbook Dream of the Black Wolf. He has published three other poetry collections, Learning to Dance, Everything I Need, and Detail from the Garden of Delights. In his poem, Cashier's Dream, The Hunt, Keith draws upon his experience as a bookseller. He also manages the Shaman Drum Bookshop in Ann Arbor. He draws upon that experience to describe a common retail transaction as being, quote, the hunt, the clear air of early morning. He goes on to write, I thank the gods of the hunt, the spirit of the beasts, and I thank you when you tuck whatever thing I've sold you under your arm and begin to leave, returning to your careless, ordinary day. Keith may not take you out of your careless, ordinary day each and every time he sells you a book, but he does almost every time you read or hear one of his poems or short stories. Please welcome Keith Taylor.
Cornerstone essay, that was very nice of him to say that, wasn't it? It's just because it's the longest in that journal. All right, Michael, thank you. Thank you, Mark. Oh, yes, the retail environment. I take it with me everywhere I go. The last time I read at Michigan State campus, I think maybe there was no one in the audience other than Mark who was here, but I was wearing the hat of a nature writer. And when I'm going to come up in a couple of weeks to help launch this at Schuller's, is that where we're doing this? End of the month sometime? I'm going to be reading a little bit from that part of that night, and then I will have that hat back on. So I thought I'd not do that tonight, even though those poems have a lot to do with, most of them have a lot to do with Michigan, those poems and stories, and this is the Michigan Writers series. Oddly enough, I'm going to take you on a journey that takes us quite a ways away from Michigan, although it keeps coming back, circling back here at times. So I wanted to do a part of my writing life that has been important to me and central to me, ideas, images that have got their hooks in me that I can't seem to shake, even when I want to shake them. Stories from this life present themselves to me, and I feel that they need to be told. What am I doing? It's the beard on there. We talked about that. So I'm going to keep my head up so the beard doesn't get in the way of the microphone. And I'm going to have to tell you some personal stories first. When I came to Michigan, I came here not really planning to. I came because my life had fallen apart, and I decided to go to graduate school. And I went to the one university, my sole criterion for graduate school, this was all I knew about those things at the time, was to go to the one that gave me the most money. And the one that gave me the most money was Central Michigan University. So I came to Michigan in 1975. I like to tell people sometimes that I moved to Mount Pleasant from Paris. And it was a shock. But while there, I discovered that the things I began to write about, things that interested me, this would not be a great revelation for many Americans, I think, but it was a shock for me that I could write about my own background, and that there were things in that background that were interesting, and there were stories in there that were worth telling, and no one else was going to tell them if I didn't. My background is rural, is Western Canadian, and is Mennonite. So I grew up in you're Mennonite too? All right. My group was a small splinter group, evangelical Mennonite group, which now has gone through several changes and doesn't seem very Mennonite anymore. So I started experimenting with some of these things, writing poems, and the poems came as a great revelation. That I could do this poem, that sometimes they'd even be nice. I'm going to read you a couple. They started out rather vague at first. Let me read you one of these ones that I think now is being a rather vague poem, because I was just beginning this process of exploration and didn't really understand it yet. So this poem is called Innocent Confusion. After harvest in Alberta, we children of the hard God were never certain of our sins. We found ways to pass, but not forget, the endless list of forbidden joys that governed our waking. When the CBC showed westerns, we went next door to watch John Wayne almost win the very land we lived on. But it was hard, I tell you. Our words blurred. Calgary, Calvary, Cavalry. And our beds, lifted at moonrise, pushed through the window, took off like magic flying mattresses over cows, over wheat fields, over horses, plunging up a low hill we wanted to name Golgotha. The memory of that poem was that since we just lived 50 miles north of Calgary and heard about Calvary weekly, bi-weekly, three times a week, I was seven before I, realized that Christ wasn't crucified 50 miles down the road. It was one of those great shocks. As I worked along in those poems and sort of got them together and became this first little chapbook that I did, in that process my mother died and I inherited all of her family stuff, the photographs, the letters, the family documents. And some of this was able to get quite a bit more specific. Her father, her Irish immigrant father, had died at the age of 32, 4 months before she was born. So she'd never known him, of course. And her mother had written, who was a great sentimentalist, had written a book for my mother about her father, about my grandfather, that she gave to my mother on her 13th birthday in 1934. I had that book, and it had the story that my grandmother told about her husband's death, and I tried to create a poem out of that where I quote things, I summarize photographs, and things like that. So there's a lot of words in this poem that aren't mine, but it's called Creation Story. Because he died young, because he never saw his child, because he was the only man she had, she nurtured her scrapbooks, her photographs. He smiles, pulling his broad-brimmed hat low over one eye, playfully riding the plow. Behind him, miles of prairie grass. She forgot the hours when he climbed down to vomit into the fresh furrows. She forgot the body stretched out on three bales of hay, the mortician who cut open his head with a hacksaw and found a clot the size of a child's ball at the base of his brain. She remembered his death only as a fog lifting slowly at sunrise, leaving her in new light alone with a child. she guarded his letters. I'm doing my own seeding, have about 90 acres in, and the first sowing, wheat, is up nicely. I'm hard after the balance. I have a good fat outfit this year. She wrote poems for Father in heaven, filled with the sea she'd never seen, her farmer turned Christian voyager, his mouth set firm against the taunt of death. His eyes grew greener, his hair thicker, until she finished her picture, her phantom, the father for her child. You'll see that as the story develops, I don't have many laughs in this story yet, and before the book is actually finished, hopefully there'll be some light moments. Before I get away from these early poems from 15 to 20 years ago, I better read one that at least is mildly funny, because it may be the last chance for a chuckle in the next half hour, 40 minutes. My group, my sect, was of theologic importance to them is that whole idea of the rapture, that moment before the end times when the trumpets will blow and all the good Christians living and dead will rise to be with the Lord. And then the poor sinners will be left behind in waiting for their eternal damnation. Living in a rural environment and often finding oneself alone as a child and hearing about this rapture constantly. I remember being afraid once, twice a week. You know, this was it. It had happened. You know, come in, where's my? You know, we've all gone to be with Jesus and I'm down here all alone. So this poem is called Guilty at the Rapture. All things good would rise into air, pulled from dirt and sky, from cars left driverless below, slamming into trees. That would be my first clue. On my ride home from the river, burning on my gold Schwinn and sucking hard on a mint to smother the newspaper cigarette I'd just smoked in a stand of scrub willow, I would have to dodge machines abandoned by vanished Christians, glorified while driving back from work after centuries of trial. I would know a final loneliness before I screamed through the back door and found supper smoldering over gas, my parents gone, even my sister, only a hair less guilty than I, called to her celestial chorus. I would be alone in a world of smokers, crooks, murderers, of moviegoers, gamblers, and sex fiends. Left at last, alone in a world without one hope of grace. I wrote those poems and I liked them, and they sort of did nice things for me around the world, and I was pleased with them, but I didn't want to write anymore. It was nice. It was liberating for me. It gave me a whole new set of things, and I said, I can write about this, but I want to do other things. Then when I started fiddling with stories, again, some of these other things sort of presented themselves to me, and I said, well, you know, that's too good to pass up. One that I remembered from very early in my father's, my father, who is a farm boy who became a preacher, in this group. My father is a minister, retired now, but still very much a minister. My group used to do the wonderful old ritual of some conservative Protestant sects, not very many people do it anymore, of the foot washing, when in memory of what Christ did at the Last Supper, they would go around and wash each other's feet. Wonderful act of intimacy for people who were not very intimate about anything else. I thought this was great. My mother, of course, hated it. And I remember this, and I said, well, this has to get down, because even my people don't do it anymore, which is too bad. So this is called the foot washing. When Reverend Alvin Traub, the district superintendent of the province, visited the Didsbury Church, he celebrated communion. After the grape juice and biscuits, he officiated at a foot washing. Reverend Traub explained the theological foundation of the ritual. It was based on an episode in John's Gospel that's not mentioned in the other records of the famous supper. John says the Lord bent down beside the table, poured water into a basin, and washed the feet of the disciples, even the feet of Judas, just moments before he turned and fled for his silver in the tree. Peter tried to refuse, then said, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and head. The foot washing created arguments in our house. Mother hated it. She had to go to a room with the other women, wrestle with hose and garter and girdle, then come back to the sanctuary with pale, bare legs. She worried about her foot odor. She didn't want to touch the feet of the old ladies, and she dreaded kneeling in the puddles that inevitably collected on the floor of the church. Besides, she was ticklish. But Father enjoyed the service.
He liked to watch the deacons scurrying around with the little granite basins, emptying dirty water and coming back with clean. They were careful not to slop before the altar. He remembered his initiation to foot washing, the time he first met Alvin Traub. Reverend Traub was a former farmer and carpenter who had educated himself to ordination and the presidency of the Bible College before being appointed the superintendent of the entire district. He'd become a legend in our church. Reverend Traub came down the aisle, touched my father's shoulder, and said, "Son, I would like to wash your feet." Father was only 18, in his first year of ministerial studies, and was very uncertain of his calling. He remembered shaking so hard he had trouble removing his socks and rolling up his pants. The old man knelt before him and gently lifted his foot into the basin. When Reverend Traub finished, Father offered to return the ritual. The old man's feet were the largest my father had ever seen. They were covered with bunions. But Father's clearest memory of that day was that when he lifted one of those gigantic feet and placed it in the basin, he felt as if he were lowering a newborn animal, a calf maybe, or a lamb, down into water for its first swim. I'm not a writer who's afraid to say that things I write are about something. I mean, I understand why writers are aesthetically don't want to do that, particularly poets, but even story writers, they're, you know, well, what's that about? Well, I don't want to say what it's about. It's, you know, it's itself. But I'm not afraid to do that. I mean, this is about something. And I like many writers, I worry about the themes that present themselves. Do I have anything to write about? Or am I just doing this in some sort of eternal act of masturbatory act, which I hope not. And I think one of the things that kept occurring to me that has hit me, that I've come back to in several different themes in things I've written over the years, has been this intersection of the individual and history. When the swirls of history obviously touch the individual life, and the only one I can be absolutely certain about, of course, is my own. And this has popped up in several occasions. One of these is I was sitting at a party, it was long ago, back in the days when I still used to go to parties. It was before I had a child. I no longer go to parties. And we were sitting around, they weren't talking about the first sexual experience. That's far too mundane for Ann Arbor literary parties. They were talking about the time you first felt sexual, okay, I mean, the first time you were horny, you know, there's something in you that later in life you could recognize as your sexual being. And I knew exactly what mine was. And mine was this picture that I describe in this little story. Of this Dukhobor woman. The Dukhobors are a sect in Western Canada, much like the Amish, except they have this very odd habit of protesting things by taking their clothes off, which is something that the Amish and the Mennonites don't do very often, not even in their own bedrooms. But the Dukhobors do it out there in the lawns, the government lawns. And I remember this distinctly. This woman was formed my 7-year-old or 8-year-old consciousness. And the historical stuff about Tolstoy is true. When I found this out, that Tolstoy had something to do with these people coming into my life and giving me at least the sense that there was something that might be sexual in the world, it seemed one of those intersections that seemed worth recording. So it's called Resurrection. She rose from the grainy black and white photograph in the Calgary Herald, a Slavic Venus, her blonde hair falling down her back. I had never seen anything like her. I tore the picture out and studied it for hours in the granary, a Dukhobor woman, completely naked, with more naked Dukhobors blurry behind her. She'd stripped before the Parliament building to protest government intrusion into the life of the spirit. I knew Dukhobors did this, but I could never understand their reasons. The few times they came to town, they were dressed plainly in dark homespun. The men wore black hats, and the women had white gauze prayer bonnets, just like the Mennonites, and the Mennonites were practically like us. My grandmother spoke respectfully of the Dukhobors and told me about what she called their great faith. The name of their sect meant spirit wrestlers. 70 years earlier, the Russians had derided them with that name. The Dukhobors knew that fighting with angels or with the spirit was dangerous, that it would probably wound but not necessarily kill. They kept the name even after the pogroms started, when thousands were whipped and hundreds killed, when the Cossacks came and took their children. Tolstoy, old and striving for sainthood by that time, grew so angry about the Tsar's treatment of the Dukhobors that he abandoned all his resolutions and returned to fiction, finishing one last novel, Resurrection. It had another of those characters the Count modeled after himself. In the novel, Nekhludov, a self-tortured member of the aristocracy, is called to jury duty where he must sit in judgment on a prostitute accused of murder. He recognizes her as a former servant he'd seduced years earlier, long before he realized that human beings must struggle constantly to be good. The woman is innocent, but through legalistic bungling is sent to Siberia for 4 years. Nekhludov sells his lands and follows the woman into exile. Tolstoy resolves the whole thing with Bible verses. He was in a hurry. He needed the money. His wife, Sonia, was clinging tightly to the family purse strings. Over the years, she'd learned too much about the master's generosity. He needed a new source of income if he were to help the Dukhobors. He finished Resurrection during the final years of the century. The Russians went crazy for it. Tolstoy gave the royalties to the Dukhobors so they could afford to emigrate to Western Canada, where the local governments didn't learn how to handle them for over half a century. When I was born, the Dukhobors were actually blowing up bridges and roads because they thought that bridges and roads prepared the path for the Antichrist. They calmed down over the next few years, even though they would still show up occasionally to disrobe on the lawns of the various provincial parliaments where the newspapers would snap photographs. My family were devout members of a rural Mennonite splinter group. Our church had begun to forget its theological root it shared with someone who thought she could do the Lord's work by taking her clothes off in front of other people. The Dukhobors were embarrassing. But even though our family tried to shield us, they couldn't control the newspapers, couldn't save all of us from one perfect body without blemish in newsprint, burnished by the afternoon sun shining unhindered on a distant government lawn. I stumbled there in the end. This piece appeared first in the Michigan Quarterly Review, which has one of the great editors in the country, a guy named Larry Goldstein, and then appeared in this magazine, which had a wonderful copy editor. And there's this big grammatical mistake in there that I didn't catch, and neither of those editors caught. It was like 2 years later I realized. Mark didn't catch it. He's my reader. It's his fault that I stumbled there. I have to change that. Whenever I read. The last 10 years, or about 10 years ago, I started trying to quit smoking. You'll remember that that earlier poem where I talked about the endless list of forbidden joys that governed our waking. One of the top things on that list was smoking. And of course, when I rebelled against my background, I had to do just about everything that appeared on that list. It had to be done at one point or other. And the only thing that really hooked me, the only vice that really hooked me, was smoking. And it took me another 25 years to get over that. When I began trying to quit smoking, I started writing this piece about boys smoking in a barn. Which kept getting longer and longer, and I started thinking of as a novella, or maybe even something, a short novel, even more than a novella. Just in the last 2 weeks, I've decided it's part of another, even longer project, which is the great revelation, which means I've written more of a longer project than I thought I had 2 weeks ago, which is a nice feeling. I did succeed in quitting smoking a couple of years ago, by the way, so it worked. The main plot line of this novella is that one boy from this background that I come from learns to smoke cigarettes from the kids in his town. He teaches another boy to do that. That boy goes home, smokes a cigarette in his father's, the hayloft of his father's barn. Of course, the barn burns down, and the first boy feels guilty about it for the rest of his life. What I've changed in this big project I'm working on now is I'm mixing fictional voices and things that are very obviously not fiction. Which you'll see in a couple minutes. I don't really know if it's going to work yet, and one should probably not read these in front of an audience, but, you know, I like that. I like to do that. I mean, you're definitely into the process here. This is very early. So the novella part, the boys smoking part, became a kind of a trunk in which I could pile all these images from my past that I remembered and didn't want to lose. So I start out, here's one I start out, a digression that starts out about my parents' love affair, such as it was. My father became the president of this very small little Bible college, which no longer exists, 50 students in this very small little town, which does still exist. And before that, he'd been a student there, which for him was the great moment of his life to get off the farm. My father had come to the Bible college straight from the farm, a zealous recent convert from a comparatively relaxed Lutheran background. My mother had come down from Edmonton, where my grandmother ran a mission for alcoholics, directed a home for unwed mothers, and worked tirelessly to further the interests of our church. If we had saints, which of course was something we never considered, then my grandmother would have been one of them. Everyone knew her and treated her with a pious reserve made up of awe and reverence. However class may have been defined in our small group, my father was definitely from much lower down than my mother. But he was bright, articulate, and promising. The church had hopes for him, and he had hopes that my mother might find him interesting. In the winter of their second year as students, the people who would become my parents were sent out to the western part of the province on a college-sponsored deputation tour. Many of the more isolated churches, the ones that seldom saw missionaries home on furlough from the foreign fields or never had a visiting evangelist, asked the college to send out students to provide a variation in the Sunday services. The visiting students were treated with a certain awe by these small congregations, as if they brought the word from the larger world where valiant, sophisticated Christians met the best Satan could offer and emerged victorious. My father learned how to preach on these tours, and my mother sang in a women's trio and played the piano. Although the students preferred the trips in the early fall, when the mountains turned golden as the aspens changed and the sky had its deep alpine blue, most of their trips were done in the snow. Winter was our usual condition. The snows would usually start in October, and even though they were often broken by the dramatic thaws carried in over the mountain on the Chinook winds, they would continue through April and very occasionally into May. Those of us who lived there learned how to be comfortable in the cold. We plugged the block heaters of our cars in every night. We knew how to put chains on tires long before we knew how to drive. We knew how to ice skate even though no one could afford to ski. We read books in winter. We took care of our livestock. We had long dinners and conversations. And we went to church, sometimes 4 or 5 times a week during the darkest months of the year. The demand for student deputation teams was greatest during the coldest months, and the Bible College was happy to send them. My parents and their friends would all try to fit in one car. They had to pay for their own gas and the upkeep on their cars, although most of them were from farms and knew how to keep machines running. The churches they visited gave them a place to stay and provided good, large meals, roast beef and potatoes, canned vegetables, homemade bread and pies. The money collected in the love offerings was taken back to the college. The students considered it a privilege to go on deputation, both to do the Lord's work and to have some time away from the routines of the college. On that trip, during my parents' second winter as students, the weather was particularly difficult. Arnie Snyder, who in this book becomes the father of the second boy, the boy who the narrator teaches how to smoke cigarettes, Arnie Snyder was driving his Depression-era Ford, which had a heater that worked, if not well. It was snowing heavily, and the temperature was well below zero. My father sat in the front, my mother and the other two women in her trio huddled under blankets in the back. They were headed far out into the foothills to a tiny little church some 40 miles from the nearest town. The service was at 7. They'd given themselves plenty of time, but they were still delayed by the snow. It got dark shortly after 5, and the snow fell thicker. It swirled into the headlights from the blackness around them. Arnie tried to find the middle of the gravel road and stay there. They didn't have to worry about oncoming traffic or even about turns. There were none of either. The road wound through the hills, through the forests, and over the frozen streams. The students were not worried. This was the world they had grown up in. They knew it well, and they knew the Lord would protect them. They were not even worried when, without warning, the car sputtered to a stop. Arnie and my father climbed out to get the car going again, just as they had done 100 times before. But this time, they couldn't do it. Nothing they tried worked. Their hands grew cold, then numb, but still they weren't worried. And still the car wouldn't start. The men were concerned about soiling their suits and white shirts. They knew that in addition to presenting the word, they had to look as if they were chosen for the presentation. Although the people they would preach to respected hard work and would listen with just a hint of scorn if they thought these young preachers couldn't fix a car, they would be disturbed much more by obvious oil stains. After half an hour's work, Arnie and my father decided that one of them should set off for help. Since my father was scheduled to be the main speaker that night, Arnie Snyder thought it best if he set off walking. Even now, the group was not particularly concerned. They respected the cold and the snow. They knew about the distances and their lack of warmth. But their lives in this climate had given them a clear sense of their limits, and they weren't anywhere close to the outer edge yet. They huddled in the car and said a quick prayer before Arnie started out. Dear Heavenly Father, we commend ourselves to thy mercy. If it is thy will that we reach the service tonight, we know that thou wilt help us. If not, we ask only for thy continued protection and guidance. Be with Arnie as he walks for help. We ask it in the loving name of Jesus. Amen. And Arnie set off, gone into the snow before they had a chance to wave. My father and the three women wrapped what blankets they had around them and talked. They planned the service they still hoped to present. They gossiped a bit about their fellow students and their teachers. They talked about their homes, and the women practiced the songs they planned to sing that evening. My mother's clear alto filled the car with the warm and sensual music of I Come to the Garden Alone While the Dew is Still on the Roses. Despite her effort to warm herself, my mother, the only child of the city in the car, began to shiver. Joyce, are you okay? Oh, sure, it's just my feet. They always get so cold. She tried to sit on her feet, and the other young women tried to snuggle close to her to share their warmth. It didn't help. At some point in this snowstorm, with the woman who had become his wife shivering behind him, my father made a momentous decision, probably one that was as profound as any he had made since his conversion. He had been attracted to my mother. Decades later, he would tell me that he remembered the shape of her breasts, pushing out the reserved, careful dresses she always wore. But he didn't know her well. He knew that she was from a unique and important family in the church. He was just a farm boy who felt the presence of the Lord. He knew about the horrors of sinful and lustful thoughts, and despite the weight of his knowledge, he decided to rub my mother's feet. He got out of the car, went to the back door, and opened it. He knelt down in the snow. My mother put her chilled feet into my father's hands, and he began to rub them. Nobody said anything. He didn't do it gently. He wasn't caressing her feet, and he didn't want anyone to think that was even in his mind. His hands didn't travel up any farther than her ankles. He rubbed furiously and for a long time until my mother's feet were burning. Thank you, Don, she said. So that story goes on with lots of digressions around this very small plot. And I've been working on that for a long time, doing things, until... And I was thinking, well, this is slow, this is kind of nice, this is a little book that'll go somewhere. And then, now it's almost 3 years ago, it was the summer of 1996, I was going through a bunch of boxes of things that we get at the bookshop I work in. We buy review copies from academic journals at the U of M that we price very cheaply and put outside. These are often tremendously obscure books, you know, farming practices in 12th century Syria, you know, things nobody in the world would want to read. But, you know, at Art Fair in Ann Arbor, we can sell them, which is kind of fun. This came in one of those books. Let me read you just a little bit about this discovery. And I have yet to build a bridge between the piece I was just reading from and this, but I think one exists somewhere. It does in my mind. I will build that bridge. It may take me a couple of years, but I will build it to unify these two stories. In July 1996, a couple of days before the beginning of the art fair, my friend Carl, who owns the bookshop, was going through the boxes of books with me so we could find the ones we wanted to sell. Jump ahead. Here, he said, there's probably no one in three states who'd read this, except you, maybe. He handed me the book, Pioneer Policing in Southern Alberta, Dean of the Mounties, 1880 to 1914, edited by one William M. Baker, professor of history at the University of Lethbridge, and published by the Historical Society of Alberta in 1993. The book is a series of police reports written by or submitted to R. Burton Dean, a superintendent of the Royal Northwest Mounted Police, during the period when the Western Prairies of Canada received their first European settlers and then became the provinces of Saskatchewan and Alberta. Upstairs, I was building the piles of cheap books we hoped to sell outside. The weather was living up to its cliches, hot and muggy. I was sweating and uncomfortable. It's the time of year I feel most like a foreigner in Michigan, as if I'm living in a place I wasn't designed for. Before I priced Pioneer Policing in Southern Alberta and threw it on the pile, I thought I should look up my hometown, Didsbury, in the index. There was one reference to it on page 177. The place name was easy to find. It was the last word on the page. We went there to Kansas, 15 miles southwest of Didsbury. This meant nothing to me. I'd never heard of a town or region close to where I grew up that was called Kansas, and I had no context for the quote. The entry began just a couple of short paragraphs above. William Baker, the editor, had labeled it in bold-faced type. Faithful what? True and 1907. I thought that this was an interesting coincidence. My great-grandmother, alive around then, I didn't remember the date or condition of her death, was named Mary Finley without the D, but I had never heard of Kansas, and even though there were many family stories about the pioneering generation, there was certainly no story about a suicide. I go on a bit about how proud we Western Canadians can be about our prairie ancestors and the stories we spin, the myths we make about them. I kept reading the report even though I didn't see any connection to it. A suicide, after all, is usually intriguing. On the 14th instant, I was notified that a Mrs. Findlay had been found in the yard of her house. I notified Dr. Little, and then we went there to Kansas, 15 miles southwest of Didsbury. Constable Murison would almost certainly have gone on horseback. Dr. Little may have ridden in a buggy, although the roads would have been nothing but mud paths. The weather had probably turned cold already, although I doubt that the ground would have been completely frozen yet. The wind coming down from the mountains 50 miles to the west would have been bitter, their eyes probably watered. They were men who were used to being uncomfortable, but this may have been an exceptionally difficult ride. I go on to describe the landscape a little bit. And I turn the page and start down page 178. Mr. William Findlay says as follows. My great-grandfather's Findlay name was William, but it's a common name, and his place in Alberta was a common place, not unlike the other people who had combined to make up my family. Do a bit of family history summary, dwelling primarily on these immigrants from Northern Ireland. In his report, Constant Murison puts the statement of Mr. William Findlay in quotation marks. Although he makes the farmer sound a bit like a provincial bureaucrat, I began to imagine the voice, reserved and thick with brogue. Mary Findlay, deceased, is my wife. She is 45 years old and Irish. We have been in this country 3 years. My wife never spoke to me with regard to taking her life, but she was terribly worried about the hard luck we had had in this country. We have been burned out, hailed out, and frozen out during our 3 years' residence here. Like most farming families, we'd heard the stories about crop failure, the burned books, the only things to survive the fire their first home burned, were now comfortably preserved in a closet in my Ann Arbor home. I was becoming less convinced about the idea of coincidence. I last saw deceased on the night of the 13th when I went to bed. She'd been sleeping with the children for the last 2 weeks, so I did not know whether she was in bed or not. I woke up about 2 a.m. and saw a light burning in the kitchen, and I called to my wife to put it out, but there was no answer, so I got up and looked around but could not see her. I wondered what the light was, a kerosene lamp, a candle, homemade, or store-bought. And I was impressed by the syntax of that last sentence, everything running together in a kind of desperate hurry, the syntax of grief, and maybe, just maybe, the syntax of self-justification. Describe a picture I have of the family, the 9 surviving children. There had been 11. 9 had survived by the time they came to Canada in 1904. After a while, I went and called my neighbor, Mr. Alex Robertson, and we looked together, but without result. Next morning, we found her dead, lying just where you see her now. At this point, I no longer had any doubts. Alex Robertson was a name I knew. The chances of coincidence had disappeared. Alex and his son were family friends, and my family had kept in touch with them well into my own childhood. I think I was even taken to their farm when I was young. Constable Murison now quotes Mr. Robertson. I came over to Mr. Findlay's about 3 o'clock a.m. on the morning of the 14th instant and helped look for Mrs. Findlay, but could not find her. We found her where you see her now. No one has touched her since. Now the questions started, the ones that could never be answered except in imagination. Who would have ridden the mile or so over to the Robertson farm? John, my grandfather. He would have been 17 then, maybe a bit older. He would certainly have been helping his father. Did they find Mary's body when the sun came up? Was it a shadow in the grass that slowly became ominous as the light lifted? Did they cover her body? The younger children were very young, and wouldn't my grandfather have tried to protect them? Constable Murison, the Mountie, continues in his own words. We found the body lying about 2 yards from the water closet, and in the closet I found a bottle of carbonic acid nearly empty. That would be what we call an outhouse. My father, born in 1920 and an Alberta farm boy until he was released from essential duty at the end of World War II, remembers the carbolic acid they used to doctor the animals. They would dilute it heavily, just a splash or two in a pail of water. It still stung his hands when he patted it on saddle sores or the scratches along the legs of horses. They used it on the stumps left after they clipped the cattle's horns. I also found a letter in deceased room bidding her children goodbye, which I enclose. Here, just given the layout of prose on the page, I knew what I would soon read, but I didn't jump ahead. I read everything. Dr. Little performed a post-mortem and found that she'd been poisoned by carbonic acid and stated that, as deceased had stated in her letter, bid goodbye, and also that she would never be seen alive again. There was no doubt that she died by her own hand, and therefore no inquest would be necessary. The body was handed over to her husband. Deceased leaves 9 children, 4 of whom are under 12 years old. Dot, dot, dot. I stopped for a moment at the ellipsis at the end of the report. Was it part of the original, or had it been something been cut by the editor? Was it the kind of information, names perhaps, that would be of interest only to the family? But I didn't stop long. One sentence followed. The following is a copy of the letter referred to above in above report. I wasn't sure if this was a direction from the editor or if it had been written by the constable. It seemed to me by then that both of them had a sense of the dramatic that I could trust. I knew I was about to read my great-grandmother's suicide note and that no one in the family had known about it for 2 generations. I read it in one rush, without stopping to think about anything. Saturday night, October 13th, 1907. My dear, dear children. This is likely the last words you will hear of me or from me. I've not much to say, only that my life has been blighted with trouble and disappointment. I have been a true and faithful wife. Your father told me this morning to leave the place because I will not sleep with him. I love my children. God knows how I love you all. I don't want any more children. But my heart yearns for each of your prosperity and eternal salvation. You all know that your sister Mary has gone to heaven, and I want you each one to meet her there. Jesus Christ is the way to God. I know I will lose my reward, but I know in whom I have believed. If you ever get married, study the matter well and never be advised by anyone unless you love the person. To you, Sarah and Lizzie, Willie and John, I leave to have a mother's care for the younger children. May God bless and provide for them and you. You all is the prayer of your own mother. Goodbye till we meet again. I went home to look in the book my grandmother had written for my mother, one she'd given to her in 1934. The first chapter, I found these sentences so unremarkable in their sweetness that I'd never noticed them before. This refined and beautiful mother gave herself to her family most untiringly. After many heartaches and losses by fire and the hardships of pioneering in a new land, she died on October 13th, 1907. This sweet, brown-eyed, rose-tinted mother just wore out. Since then, I've been doing a lot of work, a lot of research into that family history. And the stories get even gloomier in the next generation, which, again, we didn't realize at all. And which I could go on about, but I won't. Unless you ask me questions about them. But I try to think of this, of ways of constructing this book, because I really think it would only be a half-truth to dwell. It's important that I dwell on the difficulty of this pioneering environment. We hear so little about that, or it's only given platitudinous, oh, wasn't it hard? But, you know, look how successful we Europeans have been in North America. So I think it's important to tell the sadness of the story that I've discovered, and the devastated, absolute devastation of this family. But yet, you know, I'm here and my second cousins are here, and you know, we sort of do what you do. We do what everybody does, you know. And so I try to think of ways of ending this book. And I don't know what it is, and I don't want to get too sappy. But in going back, I've reconnected with the people of my mother's generation, that woman's grandchildren, none of whom knew this story, and all of whom are now right in their early 80s. There are 5 surviving people in that generation. And I really said, you know, is it their parents had decided not to tell them this story? Was it up to me? And these people have had nice, productive lives that are fairly happy. Was it up to me to tell them this? And I really, you know, wondered about that and thought maybe I shouldn't. I did tell the one I'm closest to, lives across the river over here in Ontario. And she, of course, immediately Xeroxed it and sent it off to her cousins. So, you know, that sort of question was solved for me. Last summer, I went back to the original homestead. We found the original homestead and the cemetery where Mary is buried. She's under the same cenotaph as her husband. With 4 of the 5 surviving members of my mother's generation, and people I hadn't talked to in a long time, since 1968, for example, it was a wonderful, wonderfully moving sort of moment for me. It was great. I don't know if that's going to be the end of my book, going back to that homestead, which was a lot of fun to do, to go back to this, which is still the middle of nowhere. It's still whoa, this Irish woman, she'd still, 1999, she'd still be desperate. So thank you. I'm done. And now you can ask me questions.